A very good morning. You're watching this Biz News Briefing. It's Tuesday, the 12th of November. I'm Bronwyn Nielsen, standing in for Alec Hogg this morning. We've got a full show for you. First up, we'll get the latest on the South African equity environment with Charles de Villiers, who is head of equities at Ashburton. Later in the show, we'll be talking to Nikki Newton-King, the former CEO of the JSE. She's on a number of South African boards, and she's also chairman of Stellenbosch University Council. So we'll get a quick update from her on Vilgenhof, that story that has been raging across the media spectrum. But before we go any further, let's have a look at international markets and what happened overnight. A quick look at those indicators, and if we can get those numbers up, the S&P 500 index flat, NASDAQ also flat. Bitcoin, though, is the big story and almost at $90,000. Luckily, Alec Hogg will be speaking to Stafford Marcy on Thursday morning. He's the big Bitcoin bull within the Biz News contingent. And then, of course, the Dow Jones Industrial Index almost over two-thirds of a percent higher on the local market closing yesterday. The JSE Top 40 index down almost half a percent. Resources, the big losers, down 2 2/3% on the day. We'll focus on some of those individual stocks in a moment. Industrials, the only positive mark on the local front yesterday. Financials slightly lower. Rand dollar tracking it late at 19.11 on the rand dollar, and then rand pound at 23. Just looking at the gainers yesterday, Woolworths up nearly 4.5%. Karoo continues its upward trajectory, almost 3% to the positive. British American Tobacco 2% stronger, and Investec, the financial, with the best performance on the day. On the downside, an excuse Sibanye being out of alignment there. But there you have it, resources taking a big hit. Goldfields leading the downside, almost 6% lower. Anglo Gold and Sibanye losing 4%. And Vodacom, we see, is just over 3% lower. And so that's the international side of things. But we have got our partners at Bloomberg. They spoke to Angelina Kwan, who is the CEO and founder of Stratford Consulting, and got a view from her on where to for Bitcoin over the next 12 months. Let's take a look.
I think number one, for the United States, they're going to have to decide who will be the lead regulator, CFTC or SEC. Then they need to decide how they want to regulate, and that's going to be take a long time for consultation. Even if you look in Hong Kong, we took roughly about a year to get everything together in terms of our licensing measures. And they're very clear now, but just getting the legislation passed, and that's moving very quickly, in fact, does take time. In the United States, you're going to have voting within houses and different bodies within the United States. Whilst I see that the Republican Party does control both the Senate and the House now, it will still take time because not everybody is on the bandwagon to approve digital assets as a full asset class. But I think it's on the way there. And if the different bodies can work together, then they can actually move a bit faster. Then international work will be very important with the United States. The U.S. is a very important part of the International Organization of Securities Commissions, and they've been taking a lead. But it's been enforcement by taking cases. And what will be great is to actually have legislation in place that people can understand how to be compliant so they don't get sued or thrown into jail. And they know what is right and wrong very, very clearly. So that will really help with the institutionalization of digital assets moving forward.
With me now is Charles de Villiers. He's the head of equities at Ashburton. And Charles, I promise we're not going to have a discussion on Bitcoin, but it is close to that $90,000 level. And there, Angelina is saying at least regulation will come in where we'll understand the rules of the game and not be thrown in jail. I suppose that's a good starting point. Before we deep dive into South African equities, any thoughts on this phenomenon in the digital asset space?
Yeah, Bronwyn, I must say I'm leaving crypto assets to the braver speculators out there. I'd rather stick to our circle of competence within equities, assets I understand better and well. Obviously it's an asset without any associated yield. So by virtue of that, it's, you know, you make money when you're speculating and you're buying for, you're selling for more than you bought for, which inherent is, you know, the assets we like to buy are assets with cash flows attached, and those we can understand that are linked to the economy and et cetera. So, yeah, I'm sure there's a place for some people's portfolios, but I must say I don't have much FOMO in missing out on rallies in Bitcoin. So I'd rather stick to a few areas I understand were better.
Well, we've got Stafford Marcy joining Alec on Thursday morning on Biz News Briefing, and we'll leave the Bitcoin discussion to them. Of course, Stafford Marcy is the all-time bull on Bitcoin within the Biz News stable. But Charles, yes, let's talk about those tangible assets. And interestingly, the focus that you've got on 100% South African equity allocation. I've chatted to a number of market commentators and asset managers over the last year, and there's been such a focus on that offshore allocation. But early 2024, you turned things upside down and focused all of your equity into the South African space. Why the decision?
Yeah, Barton, I suppose it's, you know, we took the official decision early 2024, but we took over managing the fund in October 2021, and even since we took over the management of the portfolio, we have been focused on SA equities per se. It's a, you know, a team of five of us that understand the JSE very well. Just in terms of, you know, really putting our hand on the heart and saying we've got enough bandwidth to cover, you know, global equities to the extent that how our process works, we like to really do a deep dive to really understand the assets that we own, et cetera. And came to the understanding and realization that, you know, that's, we're rather going to stick to our knitting, and this is where we add value for clients. So even, you know, over the last 3 years of managing the portfolio, we've had very little offshore exposure, despite being able to take, you know, the usual Reg 28, limits. And we've actually delivered great outcomes for clients, even relative to funds that have had the flexibility or have, you know, made use of the flexibility to have a lot more offshore assets. So, we just kind of officially, went with that strategy in terms of SA equity building block. And as you probably know well, I mean, even within the JSE, there's many opportunities to diversify yourself away from SA Inc., away from, RAND-linked or should I say SA economy-linked assets. If the need arises and maybe, say, the political situation in South Africa turns down and the risk becomes too much for our investors.
So, Charles, I want to focus on, obviously, you do have exposure to the top 40, MTN, Prosus, Naspers. You'll find them in your SA equity portfolio. But really, when you talk to the small and mid-cap arena, that's an under-researched environment, but it is where you are spending significant time with your team and a lot of value being uncovered. So when we look to those mid-caps, I mean, just some of the names from your portfolio, Cashbuild, Hudeco, and then you've got the likes of Wilson Bailey Homes, you've got PPC in that fold, Datatech. How often do you rotate in and out? I mean, something like Hudeco, I know, is in and out of the portfolio. Maybe you can just give me a little insight into that process.
Yeah, so I mean, you're quite correct in saying, I think if you look at our MDD, our top 10 may look very similar to many of our larger peers, but I think what you don't get from that top 10 is that, you know, our top five actual active overweight positions are all companies with market caps of less than 20 billion. So we see a lot of value dislocation in that mid-cap side of the market. So we have the conviction to express ourselves there. I mean, maybe just your comment on those names that you mentioned. I mean, I don't like to use the word in and out. I mean, Hudeco is a company we have owned over the 3 years we've managed the portfolio. And we have, you know, as that got closer to what we deem to be fair value, we've, you know, rotated that out into other names, that some of the ones that you've mentioned there of late. I mean, as we were looking a week or two back when, you know, five out of the top five performing shares year to date, we had owned three of those in the portfolio. You know, examples of that would have been WBO and Ralbex, as well as Ultron, which is a smaller to mid cap size company that's doing very well on the back of Netstar's improving trajectory as well as their fintech business. So yeah, those are examples of names that have done well for the portfolio. Some of those we've sold out of and have now reinvested into other areas.
So short commentary there coming from our audience saying we've got to really appreciate people who stick to their knitting, who know what they do and hold the line. So again, positivity coming from the BizNews audience this morning. We also need to touch on another story, which is, of course, the Boxer listing. And that was made known for the 28th of November. We'll see another listing on the JSE. It follows the likes of We Buy Cars, which came to the market not too long ago. Alex spoke to Sean Summers, the CEO of Pick n Pay, just a couple of days ago and got his thoughts on what Boxer's listing means for Pick n Pay. Let's take a listen.
So Sean, for those who are now trying to understand Pick n Pay better, when Boxer is separately listed, will Pick n Pay still own some of it? Is Pick n Pay going to get money that will liquidate debt on the Pick n Pay side?
And absolutely.
Is there a risk of throwing good money after bad?
No. And here we have to be very guided and careful in what we say, as you well understand, all of the various statements and documents and PLSs out there. So what will happen is, and this is what we've articulated to the market, is that we will raise in the upper end of the 6 to 8 billion of cash, which will go in on top of the 4 billion that was raised in the rights offer. And then what that does at a Pick n Pay level is that we will maintain a controlling shareholding in Boxer. So it will still be a subsidiary, basically, of the company. It will be a listed entity, but we will maintain the controlling shareholding there. And then what that does is it completely reshapes Pick n Pay's balance sheet. We will be sitting with strong cash on hand on our balance sheet as at the end of this year, all things being equal. If the markets remain as fairly consistent as they are at the moment, we will get that away. And it therefore means that from next year on, we will then be able to start entering back into a cycle of redeploying capital into the core Pick n Pay business. Up until now, all of the capital we've had I've given to Boxer and to clothing, because that's been our two primary growth engines. And this year for us in Pick n Pay has been one of stabilization, Alec.
So a year of stabilization. Charles, also in your commentary, you have said that you're not expecting the South African consumer to shoot the lights out anytime soon. Obviously, that perhaps is a thesis that will come into play towards the middle of next year. But Pick n Pay, Boxer, we can't ignore the story. Just give us your take on the 28th of November and another company coming to the market in its own right.
Yeah, I mean, it's really bucking the trend of the JSE delistings that we all, it's well spoken about. So this is obviously a positive as a portfolio manager. Having more, a bigger pond to fish in is obviously always appreciated. So that's great. And maybe there are one or two other listings potentially coming in the year ahead. And obviously, if the macro improves and interest rates drop and equity ratings improve over time, then maybe we see a little bit of a offset of the trend we've been seeing. But yeah, so I think Boxer, I think, is going to be a sought-after asset in terms of the local context, particularly given, if you look at that sector as a whole. I mean, Pick n Pay corporate, with the corporate side of that business, has been really struggling. Which just makes it very difficult for investors to kind of get a real sense of what's happening within that side of the business. And then the SPA as well, have had their issues in Europe that have plagued them. So I think Boxer is going to be quite a clean asset in my view. I think it's a good possibility that it attracts some offshore capital into that as well as some local capital. So I think you're going to see a premium rated business. It's got a great store growth and space growth. Growth attached to it, so we're expecting that its rating is at a premium relative to Pick n Pay, which, as I mentioned, is obviously struggling with its corporate stores, where a lot of those are loss making. I think that management team has got a lot of work to be done. I mean, yes, they have now sorted out their balance sheet and they've got a bit of capital to invest in that business, but I mean, the jury is out as to how they're going to do actually executing on that and the timeline to actually turn that business around. So there's a little bit of more uncertainty in the Pick n Pay side of that business as opposed to Boxer.
And Charles, just as we move into or closer to December, the period that we see over the festive season, are we actively seeing investors looking for opportunities, or does everybody actually go on holiday?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, everybody does go on holiday, but I mean, even when I'm on holiday, I know it's not really a holiday that you turn your PC off and don't look at the market. So you're always checking in. But I mean, be that as it may, where there's opportunity, portfolio managers will be attentive. So as you mentioned, and as I wrote in some of our commentary, I think the results we're going to see into the end of the year are going to be still pretty muted. I mean, I think the consumer is still under a lot of pressure. We're not expecting fireworks. I think you've seen some of those already starting to come through in some of the results we're seeing. But then, as we look forward into that rate cutting environment, credit loss ratios for the banks should start improving, a little bit more disposable capital into the market should start seeing the consumer starting to improve. So, I mean, I think what you've seen in this post-GNU period with equity prices, I mean, equity prices by nature are forward-looking. So they've already started to discount some of this improvement in conditions, although we're not likely to see that improvement come through in the latter part of this year. We're probably only going to see that into 2025.
Charles, thanks so much for taking time to join us this morning. Look forward to chatting to you again on BizNews Briefing. Charles de Villiers is Head of Equities at Ashburton. Now we've got Nikki Newton-King, who is the former CEO of the JSE, standing by to talk to us about a number of boardroom discussions. And we've also got Nikki in the position at the moment as chairman of Stellenbosch University Council. So, Charles, I know you're still there. I'm waiting for Nikki to come up in a moment. And there you go, Nikki. We've spoken to a number of players this morning. We're looking at Bitcoin. I'm not sure, Nikki, if you have a Bitcoin portfolio. Did you think I was going to start there?
I didn't think you would start there, Bronwyn, but no, I'm like Charles. I'm a little bit wary about the digital assets for the moment.
Let's move to more tangible things. And Nikki, I'd be remiss if we didn't go straight to Stellenbosch, to Wilgenhof, the story that has been doing the rounds. You did pen an opinion piece in the Daily Maverick that was printed on the 1st of November. And I just wanted to really get your sense of where to from here, what your thoughts are based on the back of that article that you penned recently.
Ronan, it wouldn't be you if you didn't start with the most controversial. So, I mean, I think the first thing to recognize is Stellenbosch is an incredible place. It's home to 35,000 students, over half of whom are black, over half of whom are women, which I think is a surprise to many people. And we're blessed with very generous alumni, very committed alumni, very bright students, and a very diverse stakeholder group. So since the beginning of January, when the Wilgenhof story broke, 1,700 articles have been written about just that issue. And so what does that tell us? It tells us that what happened...
1,700 articles.
1,700, and I'm on the shy side of that. 1,700 articles of that, around that. And what does that tell you? It tells you that Wilgenhof, what happens at Wilgenhof is important, not just to its alumni, but to Stellenbosch's broader, diverse stakeholder group. But the point of my op-ed was to make the point that the noise is disappointing because we have an agreement with all stakeholders that we have to draw a definitive line on practices of the past. We have an agreement with the current students and management that we're going to roll out a facilitated rejuvenation process, the very same process that council has identified as necessary to drive wholesome change. But so the noise that you read in those 1,700 articles and the media interviews, etc., makes that process of change so much more complex. It's also disappointing because it detracts from what a university really is, which is it's around its academic project. And in that regard, Stellenbosch is doing the most amazing things. And I suppose it's important to recognize that, you know, the pain of change, we see this in our schools, we see this in the public sector, we see this in the private sector. It is not unique to Stellenbosch, but it is an opportunity for Stellenbosch, and I think we must acknowledge that. It is an opportunity for the university to show how one can navigate pain in fractured spaces and how one can move forward. So my op-ed was frankly just a call to everyone to lower the temperature. I think it's important that we acknowledge the pain of all stakeholders, that every one of us has an interest in an outcome. And I think we have to use this moment to make wholesome change, to make systemic change, and that then people can look back at Stellenbosch and say, well, that's what it means to be a truly diverse, truly inclusive environment where all stakeholders belong. And my real and honest view is that if we were committed to that, Stellenbosch, which has a very interesting history in this country's political evolution, will be able to be looked back in a couple of years' time and people will say, wow, it's moved from there to here. And that journey was not easy, but everybody came together and we're so proud of the outcome that we get to. So that was the purpose of the op-ed, and I'm quite convinced that the nature of our stakeholders will get us there.
So bottom line, Nikki, you're asking all stakeholders to stand down from the noise, give you the space to navigate this, including myself. You're asking me to stand down from the conversation now, aren't you?
Yes, Bronwyn, let's move on.
And we've got a lot to talk about. Obviously, life post the JSC, very busy. I mean, Nikki, you're on the boards of MTN, Investec, AngloGold Ashanti. I think the list goes on and on. Have you ever been busier?
You know, I was actually just saying to my family, no, I've not actually been that much busier. What is fantastic is the context shifting. You've got my three listed boards are completely different, in completely different sectors, different people. You know, Investec listed here and in London, MTN listed here, but businesses all around the rest of the continent. AngloGold listed in America, but domiciled in the UK, not listed here. So completely different spaces. I find that interesting, challenging intellectually, fascinating to work with incredible people.
And then, of course, the education side with Stellenbosch.
Well, I mean, Stellenbosch has kept me extremely busy ever since I joined the council 2 years ago, and more than 2 years ago. And I became chair in an unusual way because our previous chairman unfortunately died at a very young age. And so I was unexpectedly pushed into that space, and it has been quite a journey. But you know, there's something quite special about working with incredibly bright people. Everybody round the table, you know, are professors and doctors of this. Two doctors. In fact, when I started chairing, I said, "Look, would you mind if we were just on first name terms?" Because I was going to get the protocol completely wrong. So that's what we do: first name terms. And I find a multi-stakeholder space. It's obviously hugely challenging, as we talked about right at the very beginning. But if you crowd in different perspectives on complicated issues and you're prepared to actively listen, not competitively listen, but actively listen, you get the most incredible outcomes on complicated issues. So it's a privilege to chair Stellenbosch.
And I need to get insight, obviously, from those boardroom discussions, as you say, completely different sectors across the spectrum. But the general sentiment, Nikki, is it the same in the boardroom right now when it comes to South Africa Inc.? We've just heard from Charles de Villiers, who's got a big play on the South African listed company environment right down through the mid-tier cap and small caps. What is the overriding sentiment? Does it cut across all the boardrooms?
I think when things are at a macro level difficult, that sentiment cuts across. The question of how you decide what your appetite is for navigating that can differ. I mean, AngloGold, for instance, isn't in this country anymore. And of course, that predates the GNU. But I would definitely say that the advent of the GNU, the fact that we can have a peaceful election, the fact that people are really sort of wanting to be at work, wanting to build, this is a palpable feeling in the boardrooms. What's interesting, you know, in the internationals is they look like an AngloGold will look back at South Africa with less engagement now, because although it has its team here and so it's important to it, it doesn't have a business there. So the sense is slightly different.
International, you mentioned international. We would definitely be out of line if we didn't get your thoughts on the Trump trade, the Trump bump. There are all sorts of terms being thrown around. As we close out, Nikki, your thought leadership status, weighs in heavily. The US, give me your thoughts on how
At a personal level, I've really struggled to understand how his stated opinions on things from a values perspective can in any manner be overlooked. And I think we're going to be challenged at going forward as his economic policies are potentially quite positive for certain industries. What does it mean for our values call on certain things? For instance, on green energy, as an example, just to take one example. So I think we're headed for some pretty critical questions which challenge companies as to sort of, you know, how sure are you about your commitment to the things that we've always felt are important in bringing people together rather than splitting them. At the same time, Bronwyn, we have to start to ask, why is it that the polls and the media got it so wrong? What is it that we're missing? I don't have an answer to that, but I think we have to ask that question, because it's not as if he didn't say what he was planning to do. It was out there, but it was sort of regarded as not something one takes seriously. So I think there's a moment also to say, why did we react like that? And what does this mean for the for if you look around the globe, how many governments are pivoting right of center or right, and not really where the sort of compass is at our dinner party conversations.
Nikki, I think you've teed up our next conversation here on Biz News already. It's going to be a political one, but always clear, straight thinking from you, Nikki Newton-King. Thank you so much for joining us here on Biz News Briefing. And that brings us really to the end of today's show. All eyes are going to continue to be on Bitcoin as it goes closer and closer to that $90,000 level. And as I said at the beginning of the show, Alec Hogg will be unpacking that more on Thursday with Stafford Marcy, who is the big Bitcoin bull within the Biz News community. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Alec will be back 7 o'clock tomorrow morning here on Biz News Briefing.